Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. All right. We know that all businesses need resources. Resources come in many shapes and forms, but the wild card amongst all resources is money, otherwise known as capital. With it, you can acquire other resources. So how do you prepare to raise capital? That is exactly what we're going to talk about in today's episode of Startup Hustle. Now, before I introduce my guest today, I want to let you know that this episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Silicon Valley Bank. SVB, as they're known, has been supporting innovative founders, companies, and investors with targeted financial services and expertise for over 35 years. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next. Learn more at svb.com. Big shout out. We love the folks over at SVB. They do great stuff for startups. Speaking of doing great stuff for startups, today's guest is Garen Schwarberg, and he's a VP at 645 Ventures. Go to 645ventures.com. Normally out of New York, but hailing the Startup Hustle podcast from Utah today. Garen, what's up?
Thanks, Matt. Great to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. And you know, as I mentioned, you and your firm, you're a VP over at 645, and you guys do a lot of interesting and engaging investments with startups. I'll let you go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, for sure. So 645 is an early stage venture capital fund focused mainly on seed and Series A rounds. So really kind of just the beginning of a lot of these companies, mainly in enterprise software, some infrastructure companies, and then a small amount of consumer tech. As you said, we're based in New York, but really geographically agnostic when it comes to our investments, have portfolio companies all across the country and even some internationally. We just raised a $160 million Fund 3 that we announced back in December. So all exciting things going on for us.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about, we've had several episodes and not all of them are live yet, but about VC, venture capital, raising capital. It's a real hot topic here on the show. And what we want to talk about today is preparing to do it because it's a full-time job. And there's a lot that can go right and there's a lot that can go wrong, but overall there's some real fundamental things that it's a good idea to be prepared for. In your opinion, what's the most fundamental thing? I mean, is it just the basic pitch deck and presentation? Is it something else?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I think that a lot of people, when they're raising capital, especially from VC funds, they think about that pitch deck and they think about like what it means when they're actually in the room. But I think one of the most important things is what comes long before that. you know, whenever we're working with any of our companies to raise follow-on capital, we talk to them a lot about it. It's kind of a distinct process. It's the process first, and then the pitch second. And you have to think about those separately and prepare for them separately to really kind of put yourself in the best position for a successful raise.
So, you know, a lot of people think that this is going to, that the process of raising capital is going to be easier and faster than it is. I've been through this. I've coached people on it. I've done it. I've all of it. I'm just going to tell you, I'm going to be upfront. It's excruciating. Yeah. Like, I don't think I know. And all right. So episode two of the entire Startup Hustle podcast is titled Getting Funded Sucks. And yeah. other than introducing the show at episode one, literally Matt Watson and I felt that was maybe the most valuable thing and message we could put out there. Let's talk about that for a second. Why does getting funded suck for most people?
Most of the time people are going into it blind. I feel like there isn't a single playbook out there. And that's what a lot of the times people look for. And the fact that there isn't a right answer, there's a lot of gray area. And then finally, like, getting rejected sucks. You know, as anyone who's ever dated before in their entire life can tell you, getting rejected is not fun. And then that's what the majority of the fundraising process is, you know, I would say that, you know, even the best companies experience a rejection rate, you know, upwards of 90% of the company of the funds that they pitch. And so I don't think any of that lends itself to a really fun experience.
And let's repeat that. You said the best companies are lucky if they only get rejected 90% of the time. Exactly. Now, that's the best, because you were saying that and I had to process that for a second. I was like, okay, he said the best, because 99.9% is probably more of the overall average. I know we've had a lot of VC guests in the past, all different stages, all different industries. Most of them tell you that they're expecting to hear 100 to 150 pitches to maybe invest in one company. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, it does. And so I'll say, just for us internally, you know, we are, you know, seeing multiple thousand companies a month. And this isn't like we're diving deep into them. We're seeing these pitches. A lot of the times they're just automatic passes because, you know, they don't fall in a category or a stage in which we invest. You know, we don't touch biotech or medical devices or anything like that. So that's that goes on, but we are actually diving in and like having conversations with founders to a few hundred every single month. And we are targeting doing between 7 and 10 deals a year. So, again, it's certainly a process that, if you're not prepared for that aspect of it going in, it could be a slap in the face early on.
Well, I think one of the things when it comes to preparing to raise capital is aligning yourself with the right, air quotes here, stuff, you know, and firms. Because, all right, so I'll give you an example. As you're aware, I'm the CEO and founder of Fullscale. Go to fullscale.io if you want to see what we do. We build software teams, but we're a service company. And that's not even something your firm would invest in, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
So I'm wasting my time even sending my stuff in. Which is fair. I mean, that's fair, because you don't invest in my type of business. Yep. So you talk about, you know, like the thing is if you're preparing, align yourself with investors' options and just like put yourself in the right lane. I mean, if you're trying to play football and you're at center court of the Lakers, you know, hardwood floor, you're not in the right arena. And you know, so with yesterday's guest, we were talking on VC, and that was a guy named Ron Shigeta, and he was trying to figure out how many, so he's old like me, sorry, Ron, if you're listening, but he was, you know, he's out in Berkeley, California, and he was talking about remembering when there was only 20 to 30 VC entities, and he was trying to figure out how many there are now, and there's literally thousands. like he estimated 5,000 plus. I don't know if you know, but does that sound about right?
Yeah. I mean, over the last 10 years, there has been an absolute rise in what you call micro funds. You know, these folks that have raised between, you know, five and $20 million to be able to go and invest. They're writing smaller checks typically. But that's right. There's been an absolute prolification of capital out there. And in a lot of ways, that's great for the entrepreneur. You know, there's mm-hmm. more opportunities to get funded. You're not going to the same four or five Silicon Valley institutions. And like they're really the gatekeepers to capital in the space. And so I think that there's, you know, some negatives to it as a, you know, like there's just so, you know, the VC industry right now is what we call frothy. You know, like people are getting money from anywhere, but for the founders, it's a very positive thing. Not only is there more places to find capital, also VCs are having to invest in these value add services in addition to capital to make themselves stand out for those best companies who can really choose to raise from anyone they want.
And I want to come back to the value add in a second, but so with any strength usually comes weakness, and people don't realize that, but your biggest strength is often your biggest weakness. For me, I'll give you an example. I'm a talker, which can be a strength. It can be a weakness. Now with 5,000 plus funds, regardless of their size, that's a big strength for the individual startup founder. At the same time, it's a weakness because where the hell do you start? Right. Yeah. And, you know, that's what we're talking about. So, you know, as a salesperson, all right, so I'll give you an example. I used to sell pianos a long time ago, and yeah. I had this big store in Washington, D.C., and you walk in and there's 150 pianos in there. Well, Mary Jane Homemaker, who just walked in with her five kids that were about to destroy my store. Wait, we're getting off track. No, but she walking in wasn't going to buy all 160 units in the store. So the very first thing we had to do was try to, okay, what are you looking for? I want a grand piano. Okay, cool. Now we just put 120 of them off that we know she doesn't want to buy, and we're down to 40. Now, the thing is if I sat there and tried to sell her every single item, all 160 in the store, I probably wouldn't have made a sale because 8 hours later, we still wouldn't have gotten to what she wanted to do. Yeah. So the same way with sales, where you're qualifying and you're trying to figure out the right fit, you're selling. Like, and if you don't believe that you're a salesperson as you're preparing to raise capital, you need to open your eyes, because that's exactly what you're doing.
That's right.
You're selling yourself. In many cases, you're selling yourself almost more than the company.
Yep.
But beginning to segment what funds do what, how they do it. Now, you mentioned at 645, you guys are seed and earlier stage. There are definitely there's probably more seed and early stage funds out there than anything else. Maybe not by overall volume invested, but by number of firms, I would think that there are probably more of them. But explain for those that are still new to the process, what a seed and an early stage investment firm, like what who qualifies?
Yeah, absolutely. So the stages have been mixed over the last, you know, 10 years or so. So there's not necessarily a core definition of what seed is, what Series A is, so on and so forth. But in general, seed is what we like to talk about, folks that are still trying to find product market fit. They maybe have a great idea and it has potential to grow into something very large, but they don't have an exact definition of who their core customer is yet and haven't necessarily found that place in the market. Once you hit Series A, that starts to change, and you've started to experience early signs of that traction, of that product market fit. And so really leaning into that can allow you to, you know, raise larger rounds at higher valuations as a result of it, like being de-risked in some regards for the VCs, which are funding you.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good way to put it. So for those of you listening, if you want to listen to myself and Matt Watson's 52-part series about how to start a tech company. You can hear that every Wednesday on the Startup Hustle podcast. But one of the episodes that we recently recorded was the reasons that startups fail. And a lack of a product market fit is number one. Well, technically number one is they ran out of money, but we excluded that because that's kind of a default answer for all of them. Now, when a VC is looking at my stuff, how do you know, like, what's the conversation you're having about the product market fit? Like, how do you know if I found it? Because I'd like to believe it's probably not just me telling you I have.
Yeah. So, you know, our process of evaluating companies is interesting. You know, we really stick to, first and foremost, we'll stick to the timeline of the investor, you know, of the founder. Sometimes founders come in and say, you know, we have, you know, strong interest from some VCs. We have 2 weeks before we want to make our decision. And so we'll adapt our timeline to hit that. But in general, what we do is we have an initial call with the founder where we get to know them and we get to know their story, the product that they're building. From there, each Monday, we have a full team multi-hour meeting where we run through all the deals that each team member is excited about. Everyone can give their opinion, ask some questions. You know, what are the need to believe questions that we have in order to, you know, move forward, get to an investment. From there, we'll typically do another call where we loop in a general partner at the firm, and we'll often ask for diligence. So we'll go through financials, go to market plans, product usage data. We'll also at times ask for customer and management references so we can hear from others about the product and about the founders that we may back. And then after that, we really go through and we'll either extend a term sheet or provide a pretty detailed email or call about the reasonings why it's not a right fit for us right then.
So when it comes to, so all of that is the story of a company and the story of its founders. What makes us, like, for you, and this doesn't necessarily even mean the other folks at your firm, but what makes a story compelling when you hear it?
Yeah, for sure. So I think that there are some core elements to every pitch that we want to see and that I think can make or break a story. And so it's first talking about the market, you know, and how big it can be. VCs run on what we call the power law. So if we make 30 investments, the expectation is that 2, 3, 4 of those turn into something big and all the others go to zero or close to it. So a VC's portfolio is made off of those 2 or 3 winners. And if you're not selling a story that's big enough, then we can't buy into the potential for that to be one of our major winners. So that's first. You know, second, really understanding what the customer pain point is. And how they're facing that in the market. So making sure that you know, like, you know, this is a major issue and people are willing to pay for it, you know, to have it fixed or off their plate. So then introducing your product and how it solves those problems, obviously. And then finally, how you're planning to bring your product to market and scale the company. And that kind of relates back to that initial market piece. Like, if we don't see a big picture, it's not something that's really going to get us out of our seats excited.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You know, I've asked this to everyone and that is in the investment and VC space is, you know, do you bet on the jockey or the horse?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's
which do you prefer?
I think at the earlier stage, you need to be more willing to bet on the jockey just because a product isn't necessarily built yet. You have to be able to, see the vision of the horse that they want to build. You know, you have to, it has to be something that you could see being a reality or being an everyday staple in 3, 5, 10 years time, whatever that may be. But I think at the earliest stages, it's more important to be okay betting on the jockey because a lot of times you're just not going to see the traction or the product at that point in order to get in at those prices.
That is a universal 100% answer, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, the greatest jockey in the world riding a donkey in the Kentucky Derby isn't going to win either.
Yeah.
So, but you can have a prize winning pony, and if you put me on the, you put my big ass on the back of it, it's got to drag it all the way through the racetrack. That's probably, I'd be a terrible jockey. I think 250 pounds might be a little big for a jockey. So, now, when it comes to telling the story, what are a couple things that are red flags, like, that you hear that, you know, I'm telling you my story, and just like, what are things that send up the signal flares that either I'm full of shit or I don't know?
Yeah, I would say the easiest one is not knowing your metrics that matter, you know, like, a lot of the times, you know, you'll have all of the pretty metrics in your deck and you'll have the ones that you've hit on during your pitch practice. And so all of that, but then there's a nuance that we notice and we ask about, you know, okay, what is the, you know, what's the actual percentage of your customers that are paying for the product right now? Let's say there's a freemium model. And so we understand what your revenue numbers are, but like, what are the percentage of your customers that are actually paying? And not being able to answer that kind of stuff offhand is a red flag for us, because that's what, you know, typically we're speaking with the CEO or COO, co-founder, and those are things that just need to be, you know, part of your everyday knowledge, everyday language, if you're in that role.
Yeah, it's kind of an old adage. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's hard in early stages, because one of the things that, and, you know, I don't make investments the size that you have, but, you know, we've invested almost $1.5 million in the last 18 months here and regionally in different startups. And, you know, when it comes to the numbers, with the earlier the stage, the harder it is to have any idea. And some of the things like that I'm looking for is people, okay, well, what's your cost of acquiring a customer? And they'll be like, $32. Okay. So how many customers have you acquired at that rate? Cause I find a lot of times, you know, the sample size is like 5.
Yep.
And that's kind of tough to buy into, because the question is, well, I'll give you an example. Like, it's real easy to place a Facebook ad at $15 a day and be like, oh, it's 50 cents. It's 50 cents a click. That's what it costs. Well, the thing is, and Facebook will even show you while you're placing the ad that becomes really steep. So if you have to go from $15 a day to $150 a day, that might now cost you $1.50 a click. But yeah, if you need 10,000 clicks a day, you need 10,000 clicks a day. So, and I know that that's not exactly related to VC, but the point is not everything scales in a linear way. So, right, you know, trying to find 5 new customers a month as opposed to 500 might be a dramatically different thing. And then another, you talk about, well, the TAM or the total addressable market. Some things are so deeply niche.
Yep.
That you got to look at that. Like, one of the platforms that we actually invested in is called Stenovate, and that's here in Kansas City. And they deal solely to court reporters. Now, because they only have one other competitor in the entire market, we were cool with that. But we had to really look at that and say, like, well, how many court reporters are there? How many stenographers actually exist? And then it's like 100,000, right? And then how many of them want this tool? And then you're like, okay, that's another number. And then now go back to my discussion of these metrics. Like, if your plan involves needing to add 20,000 users, holy shit, that could be like 40% of the entire market. So you got to have something that's pretty universally adopted to be able to get there. Now, at the same time, you often hear there's riches in the niches. So, you know, some of the best advice I've ever received on this podcast, I think it was episode 12, and I need to look this up because I've quoted this too many times to not know, but Laryl Holt, who is the founder of CarStar. Now, you're from Kansas City, so you've probably seen CarStar all around town. They made auto body shops like a franchise model. So they provided the infrastructure. So Laryl was the founder of that. And And his sister-in-law worked for me at a prior company. He was also in my book, Balance Me. But Lyril came on the show and I said, Lyril, tell us who you are. He goes, I'm a coward. And I was like, what are you talking about, man? You're brave as hell. He goes, no, I like to take things that no one else is doing and I go do them in places where everyone will leave me alone so I can get real good at it.
Yeah.
But the thing was, is when he says he was a coward, he's not brave. He's not David taking on Goliath. So when you look at niche and stuff like that, how does a VC firm look at that? Like, is that calculated into the mix, or like, cause you say the big, I want to build a search engine. I got a huge total addressable market. It could be a $1 trillion thing, but I'm guaranteed to not beat Google.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. I think that there is a balance there. You know, a lot of people viewed Uber as niche when it first came out because they were going after the black car market, or that was the story that they were telling, is that they were enabling, you know, high net worth individuals to easily order black cars whenever they wanted. Now that was never their full vision. Their full vision was to take in, you know, completely revolutionize the transportation industry, and which they've been able to do. But I think that So that's one example, is that you really have to understand not only who is their initial customer profile, but also their ideal customer profile that may come 1 year, 2 years, 5 years down the line. So that's number one. And then number two, I think that there is room for products disrupting, you know, sleepy, unsexy markets. So like these folks that are coming in, and yeah, there's already someone doing it, but it's not necessarily a thing. But like, what you have to do is understand truly, you know, what percentage of whatever market they could capture, and then what is the price that they're charging in order to really understand the true opportunity, the true value of that company.
Speaking of capturing a large percentage of the market, you know, Silicon Valley Bank does about 50% of the background funding and banking for companies that hit a Series A status. And it seems like a good time to remind everyone that this episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Silicon Valley Bank. SVB has been supporting innovative founders, companies, and investors with targeted financial services and expertise for over 35 years. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next. Learn more at svb.com. You're pretty familiar with those guys.
We are, you know, many of our portfolio companies work with Silicon Valley Bank. We're close with a few of the team members over there, and you know, in addition to all the banking services, they've continued to kind of build out their value add offering similar to VCs. And so it's, you know, certainly a great option for folks looking for banking services for their startups.
Banking's tough for startups in general. We're glad to have them. They're one of our title sponsors at the new Startup Hustle TV show that's been out. At the time of this recording, we're on day 9, man. Day 9.
So
I think the best advice I can give everyone listening is don't start your own TV show. So let's try to get that funded, by the way.
Right.
God, I can only imagine how many no's do you go through on the way to that. That was an interesting process. You talk about learning how to do a lot of shit and learning how to do it really quickly. Like, what's a sizzle reel? I don't know. Let's figure it out. And I remember watching a video that I made that literally told me, he's like, yeah, don't start your own TV show because it's probably never going to get picked up. I'm like, this is super inspiring.
The only way to learn, man, is to do it. So the only way to learn is to do it. So good for you.
Yeah. Well, it's been fun. I mean, really for us on that, the reason that and you talk about, you know, VCs and so many funds are focused on software now, but there's so many different types of entrepreneurs. And we thought the thing that I found through this podcast and just through being totally fascinated with entrepreneurship for my whole entire life is that entrepreneurs all have the same problems. We often refer to them differently and take different approaches to solving those problems, but really in the end, they're very, very similar. So, you know, we started with a story of 7 different businesses. We have 9 different cast members and everybody has the same problems. Like my hypothesis has already proven itself. So and it's kind of fun. Now, speaking of you were just talking about niches and the different things that, you know, the different solutions and problems that startups solve. How often do you look at something and say, okay, this could work here, but it has five other use cases or scenarios where it could pivot, expand, or move to? Is that ever a consideration?
I think it is a consideration. It's often a consideration, but what we're doing, you know, we're not buying majority stakes of these companies. We're minority investors. And as a result, we rely on the founders to lead the company in the best direction that they see fit. So, you know, these are things that we can identify, offer up as possibilities. However, you know, one thing that we have learned is to trust people when they say things. So if a founder mentions like that, this is the direction that he wants to go, and this is what he views as best, we'll take that into consideration and understand, you know, do we agree? Is this something that we can back? Or if we've already backed it, you know, this is something that we're behind 100% because you know the industry far better than we do as, you know, as investors at this stage.
Yeah, you know, and as the CEO and founder at Fullscale, where we build software with and for people, you know, that's something I personally look at because, you know, you have this buy versus build decision in a lot of cases. So like as the founder of Gigabook, I actually used its code base to invest in another business. That was my buy-in. Hmm. Because we were able to clone it and repurpose it to do something completely different, which was a significant value for the founder, you know, because there's all this crap you didn't have to build. An acceleration in the timeline of anything, especially in early stage, is really good because those are treacherous waters and difficult to get through. So, okay. So we've been talking about founders, and founders come in different shapes and forms and ages and different genders and all of it. But they also have different titles. So when it comes to having a core team of founders, you hear some people talk about, well, some companies don't like to invest in companies and founders that are solo, that don't have a co-founder. What are your thoughts on that? Like, what's your preference when it comes to a founding team, and like what core ingredients exist?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting question. I don't think we are opposed by any means to doing solo founders. We've done several, but it is an added risk. You know, it's one person calling the shots rather than a collection of people making decisions that could, you know, I think whatever, you know, four eyes are better than two, and, you know, two brains is better than one always. And so looking at it that way, we do understand that, and then it depends on the type of product that you're looking at. So a lot of the times, since we're dealing with deep technology, you know, software systems that need to be out, we like to see a technical co-founder there. So there's a CEO typically who's running the business side, and then a technical co-founder who is, you know, can build the product and build out that aspect of the team. Like those are things that a lot of VCs prefer to see, but saying that the lack of any of these is a deal breaker is incorrect, because, you know, a lot of times we've seen, you know, solo founders, CEO, non-technical co-founder or founders come in, but they have a proven ability to recruit technical teams from past, you know, past things on their resume. And so really looking at that and examining the team in a holistic view, is important, and saying that any, you know, either missing or having any one aspect is a deal breaker, is a little short-sighted.
Yeah, I agree with you. And at the, you know, 10, 15 years ago, because I'd had a bad experience with a business partner in the past, and, you know, choosing your partners and co-founders wisely is suggested. Because it's actually literally can be faster and easier to get rid of your partner, meaning your spouse, yes, than your business partner. Agreed. And it is a business marriage. Yes. I talk about that in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom. And it's important because they're kind of locked in. I see a lot of people either getting ready to make big mistakes. You know, they're like, yeah, I don't know. Well, you talk about having a technical co-founder, so they don't have one, and they find a buddy that's a programmer that's going to work an hour a day, and they give them 40% of the company or something goofy like that. So, you know, you get some stuff in there that isn't always a good mix. When it comes to the solo founder, and you hear the term key man, which we should say key person, because that could be male or female. Yeah. But the reason that that's risky is, well, first off, if you get hit by a bus, I call it the bus rule. What happens if the bus rule kicks in and, you know, you get hit by a bus, you get sick, things can ebb and flow very sharply with solo founders. At the same time, there can be some pluses to it, because maybe they don't need a consensus. Now, my business partner at Full Scale and also the CEO and founder of Stackify, Matt Watson, talks a lot about it. So he was the founder of Vend Solutions. They had a $150 million exit in 2012, but he'll be the first to criticize the way they set up their company, because they had five total founders. Yep. And they had this goofy supermajority rule. And like, they had to get five people to agree on anything, which was already shitty enough until they literally, one of the co-founders had some personal issues and they needed to remove him. Now think about that. They literally needed all five votes. So they needed to convince this dude to vote to remove himself.
Yeah.
And that's a shitty setup. Now, some of what could have helped avoid that are possible advisors or a board. So do you need a team of advisors? Is that advisable?
Yeah. So there are different types of advisors. You know, there are informal advisors. So those folks that are typically more on the early stage, you know, at the earliest stages, that, you know, like, we you know, we're building something, you know, we're a medical tech company, we're building something, you know, that will service hospitals. It'd be smart to have a few hospital administrators, you know, that are at least providing us insight into what the customer wants and what the customer needs. So that's that. And then there's the second step, which is, you know, more formal advisors. So folks that you have given small amounts of equity to in exchange for recurring meetings and regular insight and advice. And we see that being, you know, beneficial a lot of the times. It's, you know, it's something that you can typically get, you know, very world-class folks in a particular, in a particular area by offering small amounts of equity there. And then finally, it's the board piece of things. And this is something that we think a board of advisors, of well-selected advisors that have done what you're doing before is a benefit. However, it does mean that to some extent, if you're organizing a formal board, you know, giving up voting power to some degree. And again, it's a conversation that you as a founder or you as your co-founding team need to decide if that's right for you. And I mean, and if it's not, maybe going down the venture capital path of fundraising may not be right for you, because a lot of those times, you know, if an investor is putting in a significant amount of money, they'll expect a board seat in return. If that's not a partnership that you're, you should be excited for that partnership. And if you're not, maybe it's something you should rethink.
Yeah. And, you know, the advisory board, I don't want to call it a new phenomenon because it's been around for a while, but there's a big difference between a board of directors and an advisory board. A board of directors has some real, real deep rooted power, basically. Yep. So, and this is where I've seen early stage companies fail a little bit, because all of a sudden, well, here you are, say I put you on my board and then another investor on my board. And then that board is able to control my entire company because they have a 2-to-1 vote. And yep, that's where things can get a little squirrely sometimes, because you can paint yourself in a corner pretty quickly and have zero control over what you're doing. Now, an advisory board, and I'm gonna give everyone some advice here, because I'm a big believer in advisory boards. I think that, but you have to give those advisors some vested interest in your success, like, because the good ones, they're busy, successful people. And look, it's not unfair to expect busy, successful people to want to find value in the time and energy that they expend in the world. So you give you, it can be set up a lot of different ways, but you're not paying for it's, oh, well, 0.5% or 1% of my company. That's really expensive for a quarterly meeting. Is it? Because you're not paying for the meeting. You're paying for that person's lifetime of experience and them helping you avoid pitfalls and the good advice. And honestly, in some cases, when you're preparing to raise capital, the street cred they bring with them, you know, knowing that. And I mean, I think we'd be remiss if we would say that companies that write that entities that write checks don't look at the team like, hey, these are some really great people giving really great advice. And you talk about the informal advice. I might be an informal advisor for about 1,000 companies then.
Yep.
Because I really have made myself available just for like, well, I don't know, just input, because I like to help people out. At the same time, I don't usually accept advisory board stuff, because really, and this is grim, but the reality is most companies are going to fail. So if you are an advisor and you're owning equity, I don't know, man, I'm at this point, I'm trying to keep things simple. The number of K-1s that I had to file just last year was stupid.
Yeah.
I'm complaining about that to you, but I can only imagine what that stack looks like. But there's a level of complexity. Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I will add to that, that I think, this is to try before you buy when it comes to advisors. Especially the ones that you're going to give up small bits of equity to, as a founder, you should have a reasonable expectation that you can run a process to identify the best advisor for you. And so, identify 4 or 5 people that fit that mold, which you're looking for, maybe 2 or 3 of them are interested, and ask them to be informal advisors for the first quarter or the first 2 quarters. And then, given your experience with them, how you work together, the level of effort that they put in, and actually the tangible advice that they're bringing to the table, then you can extend the potential offer for a more formal position. I think we've seen that work very well in the past, and people get tripped up when they identify someone that maybe has the perfect background, but doesn't necessarily have the people skills or the rapport with the founders that would be desired in an advisor relationship.
And to simplify that, write your contract well so you can get out of it if they're not doing what you need them to do. That's basically what it comes down to. And I've actually had to do that. Had an advisor at Gigabook that just wasn't doing anything, and we had thought that out ahead of time. And that's related to particular amounts of activity or just certain things. And typically you want to vest them or give them the shares or whatever we would write it as simple as after 24 months of participation, and participation is defined as it's that simple.
Agreed.
And then if they're not participating, you have the ability to address it. If that doesn't work, off with their heads.
Well said.
Is that fair? Is that too mean?
No.
That's really what you're doing.
I think you have to fail fast in startup world. Like, I think that's just, it's just key is to like, you're going to make mistakes. That's just the truth. You're going to make mistakes, but identifying those mistakes quickly and taking steps to remedy them, is vitally important. And that's not to say being quick on the trigger. You have to make sure that what you did was a true mistake, not just one poor interaction or whatever it may be. But understanding where you failed and taking steps to remedy that quickly, I think, is important.
That's where the warning shot comes in. And, and then the head. Everyone's trying to get, I want to give the pitch, baby. How do I get the meeting? Let's talk about that for a minute. So first off, there's a lot of reasons that companies aren't investing in you. You talk about funds that we talked about getting in alignment with entities and firms and funds that invest in your kind of business. But some of them are maxed out. Some of them have already expended their capital. Maybe they have other commitments and doing stuff. they might still take meetings, and that's where it starts, because your first goal, whenever you submit anything or whenever you're reaching out, you want to get the meeting. What are some tips and things you prepare for to get the meeting? Like, what gets me a meeting?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most important things is something that we talked about earlier, and that's identifying the people that you want to go after and who are the right people. So that doesn't mean just, so this means what are the funds that you want to go after, as well as the partners at the funds that you want to target. You know, think through things like track record, investment themes, you know, industry Rolodex. Like, are these people going to be able to help me in my journey? Is this a right, is this the right type of firm, VC firm or partner for me? So, and then as I mentioned, like building a list of 40 to 50 of those at least, because of that 90% rejection rate, I think is important early on. Now, once you have the people that you want to go after, try by, you know, as much as I hate to say this, the VC world is still network run to some extent. And this is an issue because it limits access to capital for folks that don't necessarily have the traditional background or are from the, you know, from the coasts or went to the Ivy League school and Stanford MBA. So it's not a good thing, but most deal flow for the majority of VCs still comes through warm introductions, industry events, other VCs reaching out. So try by whatever means you can to secure a warm intro. If you don't, do your research. You know, find firms and partners that are looking for exactly what you're building. Like, firm websites, blogs, Twitter accounts are chock full of useful information on what a firm cares about at that particular moment. You know, for example, like 645, we publish our investment themes directly on our website. This is what we're looking for. This is what gets us excited right now. And so from there, if you should craft a compelling email with a very well thought out subject line and reach out directly to the investor that is leading that charge at the firm to explain why what you're doing fits directly in there. And that should increase open rates, you know, help get your foot in the door, at least, you know, a small amount.
You know, there's another thing to consider is, you know, as the folks that you're trying to get the attention of, they see hundreds and thousands of deals. So what are you doing to stand out? And I'm going to just tell you up front, folks, no one wants to see your 80-page business plan on the first intro. Keep it simple. Like, if you can't fit your core, like, that's why the one pager exists or the executive summary. And you're not winning the deal on that email. So the purpose of the email is to, or their outreach is to get someone's attention so you can talk to them about it. And you need to be clear and concise and understand and empathize with the recipient. Like, okay, so there's 1,000 deals coming through my inbox today or wherever. Why is mine going to stand out? And that is not by overwhelming the recipient with information right up front, because that TLDR, too long didn't read, is a real thing. And you got to be, you know, like I said, short and concise. Now, I agree with you on the warm intro. And the reason the warm intro is so important is because there's a lot of great relationships that have been forged amongst people in these industries. And like, honestly, I could get you a meeting with a whole lot of different VCs. I can't tell you if they're going to give a shit about what you're pitching. But the reason is because I've spoken to literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of founders. Right. I've made investments myself. I have a company that services people in the industry. And also I don't ask a whole lot. So like, can I and will I are two completely different things. So if you want the warm intro, you also have to sell me. You know, because I pride myself in not asking for stuff. So when I do ask, someone's at least going, or at least paying attention. So, you know, don't assume that someone can, will, or could. I think you need to treat asking your warm intro, the person for a warm intro, the same way that you would treating the person that you want to hear the pitch. Like, because that's the thing, is I'm not going to embarrass myself by putting an unprepared you or your shitty documents or your completely unthought out presentation in front of the best parts of my network. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's important too.
Yeah, I would say to simplify, like, make it easy for that person to say yes. Like that's and it's like, what are the steps that you need to do to make it easy for Matt to say yes, to send that email along to intro? And it's like, you know, creating a draft blurb where they can just literally copy and paste it in. This is what these guys are doing, including your LinkedIn profiles. Cause like, these are the things that founders care about. These are the things that Matt will want to send on to, you know, pique their interest. So make it easy for him to do so, is just the last piece of that I'll mention.
Life hack: if you want people to help you, make it easy for them to help you.
That's right.
Now, I learned a lot about this from book number one to book number two that I published. So in book number one, which is called Balance Me, I reached out and I asked a whole bunch of people. I'm like, hey, my book came out today. Will you share it? And like 90% of people are like, well, what do you want me to say? And I was like, shit, really? Like, you don't know how to, you know, and you're sitting there thinking, you're like, you don't know how to make a post in Facebook. But the thing is a confused mind almost always says no. So then second book comes out a few months later and I completely repurposed my approach. I literally was like, I prepared links, little blurbs like, hey, my friend Matt wrote a cool book about his story as an entrepreneur. Check it out. I gave him an image to post. I gave him the links. I did everything. And guess what? The book shot to number one the day it came out because I wasn't able to engage. It made it easy for people to help me. The first time I did not. I thought that I had by just asking, but make it easy. So I think you're spot on with, okay, give me the synopsis of your company. And I don't mean 10,000 words. Give me three or four bullet points. Give me the why. What are you looking for? And in why should they give it to you? Boom.
Yep.
You know, and that's another thing too, and this is a common thing, like, oh God, it went way down when the pandemic hit, because I wasn't seeing like hundreds of people a week. But when I was, it was like, can you introduce me to so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so? You had this lady on your podcast. Can I meet her? You know, I'm like, why? You know, and who are you? First off, who are you? Like, tell me your name again, you know, or whatever. And it's some of that. I'm not trying to sound shitty about it, but when people, when you have resources or access, people swarm to that, and there's not a problem with it, but you got to stand out. So I think that another key thing with that is, you know, make some deposits before you're trying to make withdrawals in life, just in life in general. Like, you know, if you want something from someone and you have like, provide value or do something, you know, and don't lead with the ask right away. Like, you know, buy me a drink first, just in life. You can buy me a drink if you want. I don't drink a whole lot, but if you offer to buy it, I'm probably a lot more apt to take it. Okay. So last thing here before we begin to finalize, and thanks for joining me today, Garen. This has been fun and interesting. All right. So competition concerns, like, you know, and that's, oh man, if I talk to one more person that tells me they don't have any competition and within 3 minutes of me Googling, I've proved that to be very false, I'm going to like just quit trying. But how do you look at competition? You know, you talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room or some really like majorly resourced competitor. Like, what are the factors that a VC firm looks at when it comes to your competition?
For sure. So we try to categorize competition into two categories, and this is a gross oversimplification, but for the sake of this, you know, and it's essentially good competition and bad competition. Good competition are large legacy organizations that have been doing things the same way for a long time and can't iterate quickly. So a great example of this is when Zoom came out. So like there were people doing video conferencing forever, you know, WebEx, Skype, etc. But for some reason, the entire population had just accepted a shitty experience and not really moved on from that. But Zoom was able to come in, capture a large piece, and really, you know, quickly rise to their IPO and exit. So so that there's good competition and then there's bad competition. This is something that, okay, there is a large number of companies that are either a year or 2 years head start on you that are well-funded by VCs and are all nimble and trying to capture the same thing. So we view those two things very separately. And you're right. Every single company that's almost ever existed has had competition when they've come out. And if they don't right now, they're going to at the slightest whiff of success. So, you know, I've read a lot about kind of some of the earliest VCs in the Valley, kind of back in the 70s and 80s, with coming out and what they said. They always talked about Bill Gates and how Bill Gates knew his competition better than they knew themselves. So understanding not only what the who the competition is and what they're doing at a high level, but why they're going after it that way. What will make them successful? You know, what will not? What is your positioning against them? I think that is having a well thought out plan and a view of your competition is so much more attractive than having someone say that they don't have any competition, because I think it just speaks to light years a difference in knowledge in terms of what's going on in the space and where it will go in the next 5 to 10 years.
So that was very well said. When it comes to competition, I sometimes compare, you have the game Battleship, right? And what's the easiest one to hit? It's that big aircraft carrier, right? Now think of, and that little tiny 2-peg boat, yeah, is the one you're always shooting around. Now, the thing is if either one of those are in, now let's put them in a swimming pool. Try to turn a battleship around in a swimming pool. It's really difficult to do. It takes a lot of 3-point turns and that's that agility. The bigger a company is, the less agile they've become. They have a whole process of God knows what to go through, where the nimble, agile assassin of sorts can be quiet and do things and make decisions quickly. And this is the advantage of a 10-person company compared to a 100,000-person company. Now, there's the thing though, if that big battleship does zero in on your position, they can often blow you out of the water, yes, or maybe just run you over and not even know you were there. Yes. So there is some of that, but the ability to shift, pivot, change, and adjust is the beauty of the smaller company. So, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think anybody that's in any industry, if you in fact don't have any competition, to me, that's a red flag. I'm like, is this even a real market? Because in 2021, man, we're running out of shit to do. Like, you're going to have competition. There's someone doing what you're doing. And I also mentioned in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom, the moment that word gets out that you have some kind of success is a signal flare and it draws competition to it. You're on a ticking clock. So you either need to take off and get a lap ahead, or you need to be ready to run that race with everyone else. So, you know, and once again, I agree. I think that I would be more apt to be, well, okay. So when we launched Gigabook, we gauged this the wrong way. We looked at Calendly and we were like, they do one thing, no big deal. We were more worried that Google was going to launch something like we did. And then we quickly realized that while what we were doing had a big total addressable market on many levels, Google is worried about way bigger shit than that. So, you know, it is what it is. All right. So I end my episodes of Startup Hustle. When I say my episodes, I'm not the only host of the show. Make sure to tune in on Tuesdays with Andrew Morgans, learn all about e-commerce and Amazon. And then on Thursdays, join Lauren Conaway, the founder of Innovate Her. If that isn't enough Startup Hustle for you, head on over to our YouTube channel, check out Startup Hustle TV, where we're showing you the real life in reality of entrepreneurship through the lens of entrepreneurs in any location, any industry and at any stage of business. We have everything from home builders. We have another podcast. We have a hemp company. We have Mixtape the Game. We have enterprise software, international businesses. We got a whole lot of different people, and we're going to keep introducing new cast members. If you want to get involved, go to startuphustle.xyz. But first, it's time for the Founders Freestyle, where Garen and I will give our closing remarks, maybe some advice. I don't know. It's a freestyle, whatever we want to say. Garen, what would you like to say to all of the hustlers out there that are preparing to raise capital? What are your closing remarks, sir?
Awesome. I mentioned it a little bit earlier. There's two separate processes, the process and the pitch. Think about them separately. Plan just as much as you are to actually put together the deck and deliver that pitch. The last thing I do want to say is talk about the role of FOMO in raising from VCs. And it's a ridiculous concept, but it's not something that the VC industry should be proud of, but it's very, very real. And so understanding how real it is as a founder can be really powerful. So FOMO, fear of missing out, it drives a lot of VC and a lot of VC decisions. The VC industry is not that big. People talk to each other. If you're able to create buzz amongst top VCs, the word will get around quickly. And that's the time to lean in hard. You know, once you're marked as a highly promising or desirable startup, then you'll probably get interest from other VCs who are afraid of missing out on the deal because of that power law that I described earlier. The fact that like that one deal can make or break an entire fund. They'll want to move faster so they don't get left out. FOMO isn't easy to cultivate, but if you have it, make sure to lean in and use it to your advantage.
I love that ad at the end, and it's true. You know, some of it's, and you mentioned, well, it's the, obviously that fear of missing out, and some of it's just ego driven. You know, so, it's like, yeah. Hey, I don't want to be the dumb guy that had this come across my desk and then we didn't like it and everyone else did. And now you're, I don't know.
So that's
a hell of a lot of insecurity for people that are usually quite confident.
Matt. So that's the second thing. So FOMO is number one, and FOLS, FOLS, fear of looking stupid, is number two. Like those are the two things that are driving VC decision making, and so understanding that as going in will put you in a good position to be successful.
But those are such fun, so economically sound and fundamental. I think that right. You know, I went to, at one point I joke because that I dropped out of five colleges. Well, one of them was a top 10 business school, and when I took Foles 101. No, but it's real. Hey, but look, that's the difference between school and reality is on paper and reality. Like at business school, they teach you that it goes A to B to C to D to E to F to G. But in reality, A couldn't get to C because B called in sick and then really needed to contact D. But the problem was D had an inner office relationship with G, and then they broke up. So D didn't want to see G every day at work. So he quit. And then they had a hard time replacing D, so they skipped D and they went to E, and then they had to go back to D. You get it. It's like
that's the world we live in.
It's a rat's nest.
That's right.
So that's reality. Nothing's really linear. So for my freestyle, I'll try to get this right. Prior proper planning prevents poor performance. And you know, it's true. So look, and you don't have to over prepare, but go in and be yourself. You know, be yourself. Assume that you're talking to sophisticated people that will smell your bullshit and are going to check your facts. So I go in, you know, like the emperor has no clothes. That shouldn't be you. You can't be in the business. You can't engage in self-deception and crap because you're going to get called out on it. Like you're going to go through a diligence process. And then also like people just in general can smell and when you're not being authentic and genuine. So every business has problems. There's no such thing as a business without problems. So go in and be open about what problems you're solving for your users, clients, or buyers, but also about the problems that you need to solve for yourself. Because if you find the right investors, they are more than money. And that's the way you need to look at it. Some people are like, VC is bad. I wouldn't want it. I'm like, let me see. Why wouldn't you want big bank and big help to do big things? But go in and just lay it out there. And don't be afraid to sell people on your big vision. You know, the thing that if ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we would all have a Merry Christmas. So, but go in and say, look, this is what we're going to be great at first. When that goes well, this is what we have planned. And then we have options. Which of those are we taking? I don't know yet. I would like to have your help, your input, and your guidance in figuring out where we go from there. Because guess what? I've never been there. I haven't been there yet. I want to get there and I'm planning on it with your help, but I need help with this, this, and this to get there. And just, you know, here's the thing. And you'll find that the people you're talking to will be remarkably open back with you. They'll say, we have absolutely no expertise in this area, but we know a hell of a lot about this one. Great. Yep. Okay, but I still have this other problem. We can help you find advisors, partners, sales. I don't know. You get it. But you can't. Look, people in general aren't mind readers, so they're not going to know what your problems are. They aren't going to know where you need help. Don't be afraid to talk about your strengths and some of your weaknesses. It's fair. I mean, is that a fair statement?
I think that was very well said. I think that, you know, like, VCs will find out if you're not being real. Like, you should assume that you should assume that they know the right metrics for your industry, or if they don't, they're going to find out very quickly.
They're going to figure it out.
Right.
I guess the basic statement on that is, before someone writes you a check for several million dollars, they usually check a few things out. So right. I think that that's a fair assumption. So once again, with me today, Garen Schwarberg from 645 Ventures. Go to 645ventures.com. I'm getting out of here, man. I'll see you next time.
Matt, I had fun. Thanks so much for having me.
See ya.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.